Hello, everyone, and welcome to this call for the National Association of Counties to discuss the COVID-19 situation and steps that are being taken. If you want to ask a question for the folks that are participating with us, please hit *3 on your phone immediately. Go ahead and hit *3. We'll get you in a queue so that your question can be answered. And in a moment, we're going to be opening it up for the discussion. Again, if you have any questions, you'll need to hit *3 so that you can be joined into the call to ask your question of everyone from National Association of Counties that is involved. Again, *3. And with that, I'm going to pass it off to Mary Ann Borgeson.
Thank you. Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us on this call today. Again, I'm Mary Ann Borgeson. I'm a Douglas County Commissioner here in Nebraska, as well as the president of our National Association of Counties. As the corona pandemic continues, counties are on the front lines in the public health response. Today, we're going to focus on safer at home declarations and other measures that are keeping our residents safe. On this call, you'll hear from our Executive Director of NACO, Matt Chase, Taryn Zabuda, NACO's Chief Innovation Officer, Mimi Hall, Director of the Santa Cruz County, California Health Services Agency, Montgomery County, Pennsylvania Commissioner Chair Valerie Arkush, and Clark County, Nevada Commission Chair Marilyn Kirkpatrick. My colleagues and I will take questions at the end of the call. So you all know that America's counties are on the front lines of the nation's response to this coronavirus pandemic. We support nearly 1,000 hospitals, more than 800 long-term care facilities, and over 1,900 public health departments. We are the ground troops in the CDC's fight against this complex outbreak. I want to take a moment and thank all of our first responders, our medical professionals, our public health officials, and all of our elected officials and staff that are carrying on our business as counties across the country. There are constantly new measures to keep residents safe, including the Safer at Home Initiative and declarations that are being implemented statewide and in some cases county by county. In Douglas County, we don't have the strictest stay-at-home measures imposed right now like the Californias or the New Yorks, but that certainly doesn't mean that it couldn't happen here. And for the most part, people and businesses in Douglas County are being very compliant. Our residents are taking the social distancing serious, and they are following our Douglas County Health Department guidelines and recommendations. But on March 18th, we as the Douglas County Board of Health approved an executive order giving the local law enforcement agencies the authority to actually enforce a 10-person limit at public gatherings. So that order also temporarily shut down our bars and restaurants except for to-go orders or deliveries. It ceased operations for things like nail salons, hair salons, tattoo studios, massage parlors, et cetera. And all of this is right now till April 30th, and then we will reevaluate. And because of these orders across the country, we know that business owners and here in even Douglas County, the sole proprietors are taking a hit on these actions. So we, as the Douglas County Board of Commissioners, are working with other entities, working with our community foundations, to try to come up with creative ways to ease that impact. Those small businesses, as you all know, they're vital to our communities and to our counties. I will say that a majority of these business owners have been extremely understanding and actually appreciative of our efforts to keep our residents home and to keep their workers safe. If possible, we could see even stricter measures imposed in Douglas County if we continue to get more community spread cases. We currently have 38 confirmed positive COVID-19 cases, and 4 of those are actually community spread. Most of the cases are reporting mild symptoms, and we really like hearing that. However, our health department experts do believe that we likely will have more positive cases in Douglas County that just have not been confirmed yet because of our low testing right now. But within our government operations, many of our employees are working from their home, just like many of yours, and we're closed most of our offices to public traffic. I must say that I've been extremely impressed with our employees who are absolutely working diligently through these rapid changes and uncertain times. So yesterday I sent an email to all of our Douglas County employees just to let them know that their cooperation, flexibility, and dedication was appreciated. We certainly couldn't serve our communities without the incredible talents of our own staff, and that teamwork and working together during these difficult times is so important, but we also have to remember that sometimes during these times they feel isolated and alone, and we need to make them make sure that they know we appreciate them. So now more than ever, though, there is such a strong need for a federal, state, and local partnership to address this crisis. And with that, I will turn it over to my esteemed colleagues for their remarks during this telephone conference. And we'll first hear from our NACO Executive Director, Matt Chase, and he'll give us a federal policy update and tell us about the new coronavirus resources for NACO. So with that, I'll turn it over to Matt.
Great. Thank you, President Borgeson. Thank you to the county leaders who are on the phone. And, of course, thank you to our media colleagues. I'll dive right in. It looks like the Senate package that is going to be released today does have substantial support for state, tribal, and units of local government. For us, of course, the counties, we had a minimum of 4 key priorities. One was a state stabilization fund. 2 was getting the Federal Reserve System engaged and helping us with the tax-exempt municipal bond market, which has essentially been frozen in the last couple of days. That's a $3.8 trillion market that we use to really fund and invest in our nation's infrastructure as well as some of our overall financing. We're also working on some paid Family Medical Leave Act issues where the private sector will get tax credits but the public sector may not, and as well as the definition of what is an essential employee. And then 4th is our laundry issues around public health, public safety, helping our local businesses, and really the overall health and well-being of our communities, and including our economy, and seeing what federal appropriations might flow. With the state stabilization fund, it does look like the agreement includes $150 billion for general aid to states, tribal governments, and local governments, that it can be used for the public health response, particularly for costs that were not budgeted in the last adopted budget of that local entity or state, and it'll run through the end of this year. We're still analyzing it, but it looks like the $150 billion includes $3 billion for the District of Columbia and Territories, $8 billion for tribal governments, leaving about $139 billion for state and local governments. Each state would get a minimum of $1.25 billion, so about $62.5 billion allocated for a baseline funding for states, with the rest of it distributed with a formula based on the state's population and the percentage of the U.S. state population. There also is direct access for units of local government above 500,000 population. So cities, counties, towns, and others that are 500,000 and above can apply directly to the U.S. Treasury. We're very appreciative that Congress heard the call from governors and local government officials for this assistance. As our president outlined, this is truly an extraordinary time where for county governments, because of our frontline responsibilities with hospitals, public health, behavioral health, which we cannot forget, the substance abuse mental health issues, our 800 nursing homes, our costs are actually going up at a time when our revenues are declining. The Federal Reserve is really important. As I mentioned earlier, we have a $3.8 trillion tax and municipal bond market that funds K-12 school construction, hospitals, courthouses, ports, airports, water and sewer systems, a whole host of essential infrastructure, and that market essentially froze last week. We had the largest outflow of money from municipal bonds, three times larger than any other time in history, and our short-term rates have skyrocketed. For those municipal bonds with what we call a variable rate, just think of if you have a 30-year mortgage and you decided to have a variable rate rather than a fixed rate, those short-term borrowing costs have gone up from 100 basis points or less up to 700 to 1,100 basis points. So our borrowing costs have skyrocketed. The other thing that we're keeping an eye out for is the timing of tax receipts, where counties have a cash flow where over the years they've designed it just like clockwork when taxes come in and expenses go out, how they kind of smooth that and manage their cash flow. Those counties that rely on what are called tax advance notes or TANs have seen their borrowing costs spike. And so as the federal government and states delay the collection of taxes, we have to see how that will impact our cash flow. So we are anxious to see what language was included in the final bill to give the Federal Reserve the ability to help us get the markets moving again, particularly for those tax exempt municipal bonds. And lastly, we are appreciative of what it looks like from the preliminary summaries that Congress is providing more resources for FEMA's disaster relief fund. It looks like there's $45 billion in there. We want to clarify if that's the same $45 billion that the President asked for recently or if that's additional, but that's essential to help us with our reimbursed costs for public health and overall emergency response. There's more money in there, $4.3 billion for public health. Yeah, there's even $400 million in there for elections. As owners or investors in about 70% of the nation's transit systems, we're very pleased to see $25 billion in aid for transit systems. In counties own or support about a third of the nation's airports, from Miami-Dade to, as Commissioner Patrick can talk about, the Las Vegas airport, which is actually owned by Clark County. There's $10 billion in there to help our nation's airports, which obviously have been really hammered during this crisis. So want to wrap it up there. We can take questions later, but it does look like there's many good provisions in this bill that will assist counties and our state and local partners.
Thank you very much, Matt. We have Taryn Zabuda, NACO's Chief Deputy Innovation Officer, who will talk about the Safer at Home Declaration. Taryn?
Good morning, everyone, and thank you, Commissioner Borgeson. So as the COVID-19 pandemic has evolved and expanded impacts throughout the nation, counties and states have certainly taken action to protect residents and respond to the pandemic. So we've had 600 counties with emergency declarations issued as of now, and all states have issued some sort of emergency declaration. There have been local emergency declarations, state emergency declarations, and now we're seeing business closure policies and safer at home policies enacted. So what is a safer at home policy? Safer at home policies are also known as shelter in place or stay at home orders, and they require residents to stay at home and are ordered with a set of criteria and exceptions. So the purpose of these policies is to have the greatest number of people remain in their places of residence to the maximum extent feasible. And the intent listed in most of these policies is to reduce the spread of the COVID-19 virus and preserve the critical and limited healthcare capacities within our counties and within the state. So the basis for issuance of these typically includes other federal or state emergency declarations and federal agency guidelines as well. So while safer at home policies address the movement of residents, business closure policies focus on the business entities and their ability to stay open. And typically, business closure policies order non-essential businesses to cease operations, and they also encourage essential businesses to stay open. So the difference here we're looking at safer at home policies and business closure policies. While business closure policies can stand alone, addressing only business operations, a safer at home policy will typically include a business closure component. So as of now, we have 8 states that have issued business closure policies, 16 states that have issued safer at home policies, which again includes some sort of business closure component. So a total of 20 states of policies, and we have 50 counties that have issued a safer at home or business closure policy. So these policies can be issued at the county level by the local health officer, by emergency services directors, by the board of supervisors, and then of course any state policies would be issued by the governor. The policies vary. Some are very detailed. Some call on guidelines from other agencies. For example, the CISA Essential Critical Infrastructure Workforce Guidelines are often cited in the business closure policies issued by states or counties, and that comes from the Department of Homeland Security. So what is typically in a safer-at-home policy? It includes restrictions on the movement and activities of individual residents. They typically apply to all residents. But in some cases, we've seen an age component where these safer-at-home policies are issued only for the elderly population. We see a time component in all of these policies, so there's an issue date and end date are typically around 2 weeks, but there's always an option for extension or the policy being superseded or reevaluating the policy. The policies include lists of permitted activities, which typically include buying food, medical supplies, buying supplies to be able to work from home, going to the doctor, seeking health care, taking care of others, including pets, and going to work in essential businesses. As I noted, they also include closures of non-essential businesses and a list of essential businesses, which could follow the CISA guidelines. Some have their own set of guidelines entirely that does not include the CISA guidelines. So we also see prohibition of travel by foot, bicycle, car, scooter, transit in some of these policies. We see the cessation of non-essential travel listed and prohibition of travel in and out of the state except to maintain essential business and operations. This also goes at the county level as well. Obviously, prohibition of gatherings and the guidelines or violations for penalties for violating this are pursuant with state law and also counties list that they are punishable by fine, imprisonment, both, and violations are listed as an imminent threat to public health. So while we do see a variance across these policies, these main components are typically included, and happy to answer any questions at the end on either the state or county enlisted safer at home or business closure policies. Thank you.
Thank you, Taryn. Next, we have Mimi Hall, Director of the Santa Cruz County, California Health Services Agency. Director Hall.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on this call. In Santa Cruz County, we have a shelter-in-place order by the health officer, and I want to kind of provide how we got to that place. As many of you know, Santa Clara County in the Bay Area of California is the epicenter of the California outbreak, and they are our neighbor county. So for several weeks, we have been working in conjunction with the Association of Bay Area Health Officers as a region to both collaborate on our tactics and also work in a regional fashion. So Santa Cruz County, we issued our declaration of a local health emergency on March 4th before we even had a positive case, knowing what was happening in the region. We had our first positive case on March 6th, our second on March 8th, and then we stopped counting by days. So our very first case was one of the Grand Princess travelers. And although at that time the CDC and the State Department of Health was defining those kinds of cases as travel-related, meaning we're not assuming that we have community spread, we made the decision early on that knowing what would happen in the region, that we would treat this as our forward actions as community mitigation rather than containment specific to those who are positive. So on March 9th, our health officer issued social distancing guidance, and it was very similar to the orders that we have in place, but they were voluntary. Then on March 16th, we realized with our Bay Area counties that we needed something more sweeping in light of the quickly moving outbreak in our area. So the order that was issued is now aligned in 10 Bay Area counties. It was issued March 16th, and then the state followed with the governor's executive order, which is fairly aligned on March 19th. So what the order means for the Bay Area counties is that, in general, residents stay home except for essential needs, and only essential businesses continue to function. And right now, the end date for the order is April 7th. However, this end date was chosen before the governor issued the state executive order. These orders are legally enforceable, so they we have our local law enforcement, our sheriff's office, and our police departments on board. And in general, we're asking that everybody stay home, particularly vulnerable populations. In terms of which businesses are open and which are closed, one of the important things that we did is, aside from businesses, work with school districts. And so it was important for us that our County Office of Education work with all of our school districts so that there was an aligned approach to school dismissals. And so all of our schools are dismissed, as in many counties. And the caveat for us is that it's not school closure, but school dismissal, because it's important for us that staff continue to work while complying with social distancing and that essential social and nutrition services continue for kids. So which businesses are open and which are closed? As was said before, in many of these safer at home declarations, city and county government services such as police stations, fire stations, hospitals, clinics, healthcare operations, are corrections, courts, sanitation, including public transportation, utilities, all of these remain open, and we are encouraging our residents to use online services and delivery services wherever possible. Gas stations, pharmacies, access to food, including farmers markets, food banks, grocery stores, are all allowed to continue operating because eating and good nutrition is just essential. Banks, hardware stores, laundromats and laundry services, and hotels providing shelter. What is closed are all restaurant dine-in services, and to-go and delivery services are okay and approved. Bars and nightclubs, entertainment venues, and gyms and fitness studios are also closed. We have asked that no large group activities happen, and this includes, we're a beach community, so it includes gatherings on the beach and bonfires, and this is a mandatory order. So what we have found is this: the legal order has been in place since March 16th, and we have every other day updates with our law enforcement. And what we're hearing from law enforcement is there's generally good compliance, 95% compliance is what our sheriff reports, and very few problems. And he is focusing the law enforcement efforts on large or what we call mass gatherings. We encourage people to continue getting health care, but one of the strategies that our local health care system has taken is to cancel, postpone, or delay elective procedures and anything that's not a serious need because we're preparing for a health care surge. In terms of how our residents are impacted, there is a serious economic impact, and we know that it's the trade-off to keep our community safe and to ensure that we have the health system capacity that we need in the coming weeks. So small businesses, the self-employed, our hourly wage workers, any of those with a household member in a high-risk group. A lot of families are impacted by the school dismissals, and as I said before, what we're doing to help mitigate some of these impacts is working with the school to continue their free and reduced nutrition services. The schools are also our centers for grocery pickup, so if families come and they can pick up the school breakfast and lunch to go, we also are working with food banks and volunteer organizations to send groceries home. We also have partnered with food banks, hotels for housing our homeless population, especially those who are suspect or potentially exposed to COVID-19. We're also working with hotels to house those who are being released from our correctional facilities, and our sheriff has decided to, he's worked with our health officer to have an order to release those low-level folks who, because he's concerned about crowding in the jail, and one of the things that keeps our health officer up at night. So the next steps for Santa Cruz County is that we do expect that we're going to extend our order. Right now it is, it ends on April 7th. And that is to be in line with our state executive order. We're currently conducting epidemiological modeling in which we have projected cases, including projected ICU capacity or need. And we are working on refining this as we get our actual numbers in. And what we expect is that this kind of order is going to be in place until we start seeing a downturn in the disease curve. One of the impacts that we are going to have countywide is we are, we're a beach community, as I said, and for local government, we expect a serious impact. Definitely for the fourth quarter of this fiscal year, but we know that our sales tax, our transient occupancy tax, and other revenues are going to be seriously affected. So we're preparing for that, and we know that there will be difficult times to come, but that this is a really important and needed strategy to keep as many community members as possible safe and to safeguard our healthcare system. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Hall. Next, we have Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, Commission Chair Valerie Arkush, who is a public health expert and medical doctor. Commissioner Arkush?
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be on this call with you today. So let me just set the stage a little bit for where I am. Montgomery County is a county of about 830,000 people. We are along the western border of the city of Philadelphia. We are comprised of 62 municipalities that each have their own set of elected officials. We have 22 school districts that each have their own elected school board. And we have 50 police departments that report to their municipal governing body. So we have a lot of folks that we have to bring together in this effort. We have 9 hospitals in the county, and the county varies from being very urban in the eastern part along the border with Philadelphia to quite rural with a fair amount of farmland as you move toward the west of the county. So we have kind of every condition you can imagine here that we're working with. And as you heard, I am a physician with a master's degree in public health, so for me it's been personally really a very interesting and challenging time as I wear both a governing hat and people are looking to me for a lot of medical guidance as well. We got the first report of 2 presumptive positive individuals in Montgomery County on Saturday, March the 7th. We were the first location in Pennsylvania to have individuals test positive. Now, as of yesterday afternoon, we have 159 positive individuals in Montgomery County. They range in age from 1-year-old to several individuals in their mid-90s. From the early days, we have been focused on learning from the countries and the states that have come before us in this pandemic. We had been already holding meetings in our county with our school superintendents, with law enforcement, with some of our larger municipalities, and with all of the department heads across my county government. We have 2,700 employees here in our county government to start to plan. We felt that it was inevitable that the virus would come to Montgomery County. So we were well into planning when we got our first call that we actually had individuals in the county that were carrying the virus. So one of the things that we all agreed upon was that we had a very small window of opportunity to try to put into place very strong social distancing measures and mitigation measures. And so almost from the first day, we were moving as rapidly as we could in that direction. Our schools were closed by Friday, March 13th, so just not even a full week after we'd gotten our first call. And then over the next several days, a series of orders went into place. One of the first ones is very similar to what you've heard before, where we no longer allow people to dine in restaurants, but they can still get takeout or delivery. We think that's critically important that people have multiple opportunities to have access to food. And, of course, that also keeps at least some people continuing to work. We worked very closely with our county court system, and they, in turn, worked closely with the state court system to very rapidly end jury trials in our county. We had to get a waiver around the provision that requires criminal trials happen within a certain number of days. We obtained all those waivers. Our president judge instructed all of our district justices to impose the least restrictive penalty on anyone who would come before them, with the goal of making sure that we minimize the number of people that are going into our county correctional facility. And we also put into place an order that no one would go into the jail simply because they couldn't make a cash bail payment if their crime was of a certain level. So we very quickly acted on all of those pieces. We continued then with our governor issuing an order for only life-sustaining businesses to remain in operation, very similar to what you've heard from some of the other speakers. And that was in place by the end of last week. And then on Monday of this week, 2 days ago, the governor instituted a stay-at-home order for our 5-county region here in southeastern Pennsylvania, which does include Philadelphia and the surrounding counties. And then there's a couple of other counties out in the western portion of the state that are also under stay-at-home orders at this point. I think one of the most important things for us has been regular communication with a number of different constituencies. That includes our school superintendents, our police chiefs, our hospital CEOs, our faith community, our business community, and just we're trying to have check-in calls with those groups at a minimum of once a week. Some of those groups, like hospitals, it's more frequently than that. We also started hosting a regular call every day with the 5-county elected officials, so Philadelphia, my county, Montgomery County, and the other suburban counties, so that we're all talking to each other at least once a day. And we are working along with our hospitals across the region to build a regional dashboard so that we can all see where beds are available, where isolation rooms are available, who's running short on personal protective equipment, and many other factors. So we're hoping to have at least a preliminary version of that up and running within 24 to 48 hours. We've been doing a lot of education. We have a daily press briefing most days around 3 o'clock that we stream through Facebook Live and then repost, and we're getting a lot of very critical information out to our constituents through that press briefing. And we're spending a lot of time educating people on what some of this language is. You know, what's the difference between quarantine and isolation? What's the difference between containment and mitigation? And all of these other strategies that are, you know, words and language and concepts that are likely quite foreign to most people. We've stressed a lot of mental health messaging. I think the most important one is that it's okay not to be okay right now. And that is a message that has really resonated across our communities. And I think people are very grateful that someone in my position is very upfront in acknowledging how unsettled and how unprecedented these times are. Our business community is working very closely with us to repurpose. We have actually 46,000 manufacturing jobs here in Montgomery County. Our county has the most manufacturing jobs of any county in Pennsylvania. And many of those manufacturers are trying to repurpose their work to help aid in this pandemic. One of the most kind of both fun and interesting things that's happened is we have a very active distilling and brewery community here in the county with a number of businesses that work in that space. And they are partnering up with others and sometimes doing it on their own, making things like hand sanitizer. So they're using the alcohol that they distill or brew and turning it into hand sanitizer. So we're seeing some really very innovative and, frankly, wonderful community building things happening here in Montgomery County. We were extremely pleased to get a community-based testing site up and running as of last Friday the 20th. This was done with support from the federal government. The Pennsylvania National Guard very generously gave us one of their medical units to actually perform the testing. So this was extremely important because we were able to stand up this testing site without using any supplies or any manpower from any of our 9 local hospitals, all of whom are doing okay, but they don't have people or supplies to spare. So since last Friday, we have tested about 1,100 people as of last night, and we are anxiously awaiting results from those tests. I think once we have that large volume of tests back, it will give us a much stronger ability, a much more scientifically valid ability to model what is coming next here in Montgomery County. But I've been very pleased that our social mitigation strategies, our social distancing and mitigation strategies do seem to be having quite an impact. People do seem to understand how important it is to stay home to protect our most vulnerable individuals, the elderly, those with multiple underlying medical conditions, and those that are immunocompromised. And they are understanding and getting the message that by staying home, they best protect our first responders and our hospitals from becoming overwhelmed. You know, sadly, we have the example of Italy and of deep concern to so many people here, because many of us have friends and family in New York City, seeing what's beginning to unfold in New York City. So people do seem to really understand how important it is to stay home, and we've had excellent compliance with that. We are planning for surge capacity. We are looking to stand up actual hospitals, temporary hospitals in a couple of locations, all of that work being done jointly across more than one county. And we are, of course, as everyone else has said on this call, we have our eye on the future economic, really, you know, reestablishing our economic engine here in the county. We have a thriving business community here, some very large companies, but really the heart of our business community here are smaller companies and family-owned companies. And so we're working closely with them and hope to announce some programs in the next day or two that will be specifically directed at them. And I think I'll stop there, but of course, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Arkush. And finally, we have our last speaker, who is Clark County, Nevada Commission Chair Marilyn Kirkpatrick. And then once she is finished, we will begin our question time period. So, Commissioner?
Morning, and thank you, Madam President. So, you know, Clark County is a unique place. We rely on, this year we celebrated our 50 millionth tourist who came to visit us in Las Vegas. We have the home of the Las Vegas Strip, which is our top 100 employers for the entire state. And as you can imagine, we are very diligent in staying together, working with many of our partners. But I want to go back and talk about what we did from the beginning. So we were alerted in our county. Two county commissioners sit on our public health board, and I happen to be one of those. And so we were alerted late January that there was somebody who was being tested for coronavirus and they were in one of our hospitals. So we quickly brought together many of our stakeholders that serve part of our emergency management to understand the protocols, the process, and how this would work if we were to have a confirmed case. So understanding that the convention authority, which oversees many of the strip properties, the resort association, the chambers, our airport, because we have so many folks that come through it, as well as our own local government. So we went through the, we got a briefing that day, and we immediately went back and started reevaluating government-wise, hotel-wise, small business-wise, what were our protocols in place and what were things we needed to start looking at. We did not actually receive our first positive until March 5th. And prior to that, we set up our emergency management regional agency group, which is comprised of the school district, the health district, the governor's office. And so we set up this large group of about 40 people to start talking through policies that we as a group needed to work on so that we could be working in the same direction. You can imagine that there are things that came before us that we were not anticipating. So first and foremost, where were we going to put tourists? If some tourist was confirmed, how would we ensure that they could have the 14-day quarantine period? So we quickly started working to secure locations for tourists. That changed the very next day to the priority being our supply chain. So 92% of our supply chain comes from out of state. So we worked very quickly with our federal government to get a waiver so that our trucks could run a little bit longer to ensure that our grocery stores were full. And today we're still trying to play catch up because what we've seen is our supply chain is doing 3 times of what we normally do at Christmas. So we're constantly catching up on that issue. That changed. Our priority changed yet the very next day on what were we going to do about schools. How did, could we ensure that we were ready? Even within the urban areas, we do not have online learning. There are many folks that are unconnected in our urban areas of Clark County. So through all of this process, we had all of these stakeholders at the table so that everybody could go out and figure out what best way to address it and what assets that we had. So we then stood up our volunteer coordinator who then brought in all of the assets to determine where we were missing gaps. So things so simple as our motor speedway said, you know, I don't have a lot, but I have a big empty parking lot. If you guys need it. At the same time, the Red Cross called and said, oh my gosh, they've shut down our location, so we need another place to go. So we were able to match people correctly. As you can imagine, when the hotels closed, we had tons of food that we had to find a home for. So, for instance, one casino itself had 34 pallets. Our food banks were full, so we then started assessing where our gaps were. And it turned out that our Air Force base had a big gap, so we were able to help them, and they were able to help us by taking all of that food. So today we're working to address even further gaps. We know that we have food set up for our children where they can come to a local school and get breakfast and lunch every single day. But now what we're seeing is that grandparents who are raising grandkids in particular, they don't have the dollars or gas to get and wait in the lines to get their food. So we just started a Delivering with Dignity, which is many of our small restaurants have pitched in to keep some of their workers working, and they are now preparing meals that we deliver to those homes. Tomorrow we'll roll out the 400 medically fragile seniors that don't have the capability to get out. So by starting early, getting our structure in place, and figuring out what assets we have, and what priorities we needed to do has been instrumental in moving us forward and being prepared. Today we have 249 cases that are presumptive positive, and we have had 6 deaths, all with underlying conditions. What I will tell you is we quickly had an emergency meeting on last Friday as the governor directed essential and non-essential businesses to close. We quickly set the tone for the entire state, and we had a meeting. We did it virtually. Some folks were in place so that we could then start going out and seeing. So Saturday morning, we responded to about 123 calls for folks that felt that businesses shouldn't be in place, and we made all of those. But I can tell you today the numbers have significantly dropped of the businesses that should be closed. And the complaints have completely dropped. So everybody is watching everybody, which is great. The governor, again, last night rolled out the parks that you can no longer be in the parks. We had done that on Monday. We closed down the playgrounds because we were getting lots of requests from folks wondering how we have the ability to clean it every time somebody played on it. So we decided for our best interest, it was best just to close the play structures or any hard surfaces and just leave our open space. Today, our priority is ensuring that the homeless have somewhere to go. We'll also, working with the sheriff, our jails are in good position. We were able to get thermal thermometers for everybody so that we could test not only our employees, but test our inmates to see if they had a fever right away. So we have been all collaborating, have one big asset map so we can determine and prioritize where it is. What I'll tell you is PPE is the biggest concern for everybody. We are now going out and working as a region to see how we can buy it ourselves as opposed to waiting for the FEMA relief because we need to insure. So we've stopped elective surgeries at this point so we could preserve some of that PPE. We set up a location just for our first responders so that as they were asked to be in quarantine, that we had one location that we could keep them in so we could stay on top of that, because it's most important that our first responders are able to be able to be out there, whether it's medical, whether it is police, fire, any of those. So we have a location that we work directly with them and our health district to ensure we get them back on track and out into the field. We established daycares. Each city across the valley established a daycare for essential workers so that they didn't have to worry about their children, what it needed to be. Our school district recently rolled out their online piece, but we also are printing packets for some of our areas that don't have connectability so that the kids can stay on top of the education. As you can imagine, having 50 million passengers coming through our airport is a big hit to our economy, but we know that safety comes first. But today we're looking at a $1.1 billion shortfall. As the costs are rising, we anticipate that we're now having to buy some additional equipment. We're having to pay for overtime, and so our costs are rising in the time that we don't anticipate any new revenue coming in before August based on our structure in our state. So we are working to ensure that we can provide all of that going forward, but in for the short term. So we, I couldn't think all of our employees, Clark County has 10,000 employees by itself, but we have hundreds of thousands of folks that were laid off. So we anticipate that unemployment and the needs will rise as we come to a peak. So we are currently planning for that. But the economic impacts on our economy based on the tourism is very detrimental, and it could take us years to get out of that. As far as keeping our residents safe and social distancing, we have seen some creative folks come together on how they're providing services or they're doing curbside. So we are feeling confident that we are creating some new ideas out there that we didn't anticipate before. So I just want to say thank you to NACO. You've been super supportive as we've been through this call to Congress to help us, because it is a huge impact, and that's really my remarks.
Thank you, Commissioner Kirkpatrick, and all the speakers. And so at this time, we will take questions.
Thank you very much, Mary Ann. Thank you, everyone, for joining this National Association of Counties call. I want to let you know that you can ask a question if you hit *3 on your phone. Please go ahead and do that immediately if you'd like to ask a question. One of our screeners will get with you and make sure that you're in the queue so that we can get to all the questions that are there. For those of you who may have joined late, we are joined here by NACO President Mary Ann Borgeson. We also have Matthew Chase, the Executive Director of NACO, Taryn Zamuda, the Deputy Chief Innovation Officer for NACO, Mimi Hall, the Director of the Santa Cruz County, California Health Services Agency, Dr. Valerie Arcouche, Commissioner of Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, and Marilyn Kirkpatrick, whom you just heard from Clark County, Nevada. She's a Commissioner for Clark County, Nevada. So just wanted to give you that list again so you knew whom you could address your question to. When we do take questions, please identify yourself and identify specifically whom your question is addressed to so that the appropriate person can make sure to be ready to answer it. With that, I'm going to go to Tim Craig of the Washington Post. Tim, you're live. Go ahead and ask your question.
Hello. And this is just sort of broadly so somebody can, anyone can answer it, or a couple people can answer it. You just tell me that this. As we saw yesterday, the White House stated that residents of New York City who travel outside the city should self-quarantine for 14 days. The whole state of Florida, Governor DeSantis has signed an executive order stating anyone in the New York region should self-quarantine for 14 days. My question is, how do you all see that being enforced, or can it be enforced, or what is your recommendation about that? Because we all know how many hundred million people traveled through New York in the last month. And also, do you envision a scenario as it spreads where other counties or other states may be saying your residents shouldn't travel elsewhere, or your residents should self-quarantine if they travel elsewhere, or that you have to put in a place of policy stating other residents of other parts of America should self-quarantine when they come to your cities or counties?
I'll jump in. Matt Chase, Executive Director of the National Association of Counties. This is why we think we need a national approach and a national strategy, that we continue to need to make smart, informed decisions at the local level. The last thing we want is states, cities, and counties pitting our residents against each other. This is actually a time when we need to be smart. We all need to be following the CDC guidelines. The president did put in place the 15-day kind of checklist, if you will. And so at this is a time where the country needs to come together, not starting pointing fingers at each other. It's also why we continue to push the importance of testing. There are some folks that say we no longer need to test. I think we disagree with that. We have been pushing testing from the early days of this crisis. San Diego County, we remind folks, declared a public health emergency back on February 14th, and we have been pushing for that. You can't fight a ghost if you don't have the data. And so areas that think that they don't have the virus in many places, it's because they haven't tested. We're a very mobile society. People are moving every day. And we remind folks that even when you do have testing data, that it tends to lag 10 to 14 days. So the data today is actually looking in the rear view mirror. And so our bottom line is we want really strong federal, state, local partnerships. We aren't looking for finger pointing. We aren't looking to pick and choose winners and losers. This is a national issue. It's actually a global issue. And we want to continue to strengthen the coordination of federal, state, and local. If everybody just does their part, we can get out of it.
Tim, any follow-up questions for anyone else?
No, not unless somebody else wants to chime in on that, if they have any thoughts.
Well, this is Commissioner Maryam Borgeson, and one of the things that I think is important, yes, the federal, state, and local partnership is extremely important, but I think our organization as the National Association of Counties is able to pull our counties together for those kinds of things not to happen. So the resources that we have, the communications that we have, ongoing, continuously, I think that that's going to go a long way for that not to happen and to keep everybody in the loop as to what is happening.
So just as there's one clarifying question for anyone, but you would not support, if it ever got to this point where there are travel restrictions that pit states against each other or localities or regions against each other, like say there was, you know, the state of Texas says we don't want anyone coming from Santa Clara County for 3 weeks. Kind of like what's going on at the global level with individual countries.
At this point, I don't think we can say whether we support it or not as we watch what's happening.
Okay.
I think we react as those things happen. And again, I was just going to make that point, too, that that's already happening, but on a global part. So we just need to, again, go back and keep reiterating that that's why we need this partnership at all levels of our government.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Okay, next we're going to go to Greg Allen of National Public Radio. Greg, you're on live. Go ahead and ask your question, and please address it to the person you'd like to ask it to.
Right. This is a question for Mimi Hall from Santa Cruz. Mimi, I want to ask you about this decision to issue the stay-at-home order, and I think you guys did it fairly early. What we're seeing is, in some places, there's a lot of concern about the economic impact, as you discussed, and I wanted to know why you felt it was important to do so early before you'd seen many cases. What's your thoughts on that for other counties and states that are still looking at this?
Well, one of the things for us is we were following the disease curve, and science tells us that, as someone else had mentioned earlier, that the best information that we have is a couple of weeks behind. So we understood early on that we had to take some important action. And one of the difficulties of this decision was knowing that it would have an adverse economic impact, particularly in an inequitable way. So I think what drove this is the fact that we see what's coming, all of us do. And we're a small community, and we know that all of our Bay Area counties will be impacted in terms of healthcare system and other services. So we felt like our main objective is to save lives. And although the general public cannot see or could not see maybe 2, 3, or 4 weeks ago, where this was headed, we as public health professionals and medical professionals could. And the science told us that this was a very important move to make early and to make it in a sweeping manner.
Just follow up on that.
I'm wondering when the state order went statewide, I've got to believe that there's some rural counties way out in parts of California were surprised and somewhat resistant to it. I mean, did you hear anything about that? Was there resistance?
Actually, so a bit of my background, I spent 20 years of my California career working in one of the smallest rural counties in California. It's called Plumas County, with a population of 18,000. I'm also the president of our State Association of Health Directors. And so I've been keeping in close touch with our rural counties, and from my professional colleagues and actually a lot of schools and everything have been pushing for something, because the rural counties have even more of this balance that they have seasonal employment, they have a lot of folks who are self-employed, a lot of different factors, and they're always the laggards. They'll see this later. So although there has been some opposition in the rural counties, there's been a lot of relief, especially in the mountain communities that see a lot of that travel from to and from the Bay Area, to and from other areas. And in a very, very short amount of time, I think in less than a week, this went from 30-some states to every state in the nation being impacted. And I think that clearly shows where we're going.
Thanks a lot.
Greg, any other quick follow-ups?
Do all counties now have it in California, or some of these rural counties that are still not seeing cases that have showed up in testing yet?
There are some rural, I don't know if anyone else wants to answer this, I'll answer it since I'm from California. Not every county is impacted. If I said every county, I meant every state in California, every state in the nation. So there are still, but the thing to remember is that widespread testing is not available. And so that's part of the reason we decided to do this early on. Logic and common sense tells us that we have community spread because we don't have the ability to do widespread testing. We're missing the denominator in the end. So right now, for the most part in California, we are only testing those who are hospitalized, healthcare workers with a known exposure, certain vulnerable populations. And clinicians can make their own decisions outside of the public health testing system. There are also many commercial labs now offering testing. But we don't want to rely on testing to tell us what the extent of this in our community is. We know it's here.
Thank you very much, Greg. And now we're going to move on to Stephen Sanchez of CBS News. Stephen, you're live. Go ahead and ask your question.
Hi. Thanks for doing the call. Kind of just broadly for anybody. I know somebody said there's 15 or 16 states that now have issued safer-at-home policies, as well as 50 counties. Do you know about how many Americans that equaled out to as far as population?
And who is that directed to again, Stephen?
It's really open, whoever wants to speak on it.
Okay.
Stephen, this is Matt.
Okay.
Taryn Tomato with NACO. We can certainly pull that number and get it to you. I would, generally speaking, we are seeing many of our high populous counties issuing these stay-at-home orders or safer-at-home orders, and then also the high populous states, but I can get you a number as a follow-up.
And we also have a map on naco.org/coronavirus. We are tracking those declarations. So we actually have a map that you can view, and you can actually click on the specific county orders.
The county orders are concentrated mostly in California and Texas. Obviously, sprinkled throughout the country. We have one in Idaho. We have one in Missouri, if you're in Tennessee, some in Florida. But California and Texas make up the most of the county-level declarations.
Any quick follow-up, Steve?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's go to Hannah Miller of CNBC. Hannah, you're on live. Go ahead and ask your question. And please note who you want it directed to.
Hi, thank you. My question is for those of you representing specific counties, and it's regarding testing. If you've had delays in getting testing kits or have shortages or anything like that, how has that impacted your counties, particularly regarding the spread of the virus, in your opinion?
So this is Mimi Hall in Santa Cruz County. We do have limited testing availability. So there are a certain number of public health labs in California that are approved to do the testing. And for us, for our county, the lab that we use in Santa Clara has capacity for 60 tests a day. And it's important to note that capacity is not just collection kits or the test kits, it's also the personnel and the staff able to perform the testing. We have commercial labs that have now started, and we were looking forward to expanded testing. But there's, for example, Quest Diagnostics has a large backlog, and so they have limited their collection kits and distribute only 10 to 15 kits to each location when they're requested. And it's taken 8 days to get test results back from them. LabCorp has a turnaround time of 5+ days, and they also have very limited collection kits. So the way this impacts how we treat our approach to the disease is, again, we're not relying on testing to let us know that this is in our community. So the way we approach mitigating community spread is through this order and through the accompanying guidance, and we ask people, if you are ill with mild or moderate illness, and there are flu-like symptoms, assume that you may be COVID positive and please isolate at home and stay at home until your symptoms resolve. Don't go to work. Don't go out and about. The best, in some cases, we have to take a leap of faith and know that as a community, we have to do the right thing. It's really hard to kind of use testing as the litmus because your treatment wouldn't change otherwise. There's no treatment and there's no vaccine. So we're just asking so that our healthcare system isn't flooded and our PPE, our swabs, all of these things that are needed for other procedures aren't used on testing when they will be needed in the coming weeks for actual care and treatment, aren't squandered on something that doesn't have a great amount of utility in terms of, treatment, except for certain cases.
This is Mary Ann Borgeson from Nebraska and Douglas County. And, yes, the limiting testing affects, I think, everybody. But I think the real point is how, especially through public health, we are able to do things ahead of that testing in order to help, again, we've heard for a long, long time, the leveling of our curve to be able not to overwhelm our health system. And yes, there are areas around and counties that this is happening to, but the more we can do to try to prevent people, again, being in large crowds, closing public places, those are the things that we try to do ahead of not being able to have those tests available.
And this is Valar Kush from Montgomery County. I agree with the statements of my colleagues, and I would just add one additional thought, which is that if we had had widely spread testing available back in January, then we could have used that testing to initiate an approach similar to what they've done in South Korea, where they tested many, many, many people. I think they're well into the several hundreds of thousands at this point. And they did it early, and they got those people into isolation early, and they have been able to keep businesses and schools, for the most part, open. At least that is my understanding from what I have been reading. But unfortunately, we did not have that ability to do widespread population testing here in the United States until, frankly, the window for what that could have allowed us to do had already closed. because the virus was in too many of our communities by the time we had a little bit more testing available to us. Here in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, we have struggled with the same shortages that you just heard my colleagues articulate. And at this point, what we're focused on is being able to do accurate modeling. And so our biggest challenge right now is getting enough people tested and enough test results back, both positive and negative, to help us with some accuracy prepare for what is coming next, to make sure that we have sufficient surge capacity and all of the things that are needed to take care of a surge of patients. We, too, have been using these tests that encourage the public to help us flatten the curve and explain why that's so important. But at this point, you know, we're in a very shifting and rapidly evolving situation, but at this point, having more testing data would help us the most to understand what's coming next.
And this is...
Go ahead, Mary.
Okay. I was just going to say, in Clark County and working as a state, we have established a website to show, so I encourage any of you to go to the Nevada State Department of Health and Human Services website, because we have, as of this morning, performed about 5,500 tests, and then so we do have some data that we're posting for our constituents so that they can see, because we, too, are trying to be ready for the next surge, and that is a moving target for many of the communities. Nevada is unique because we have 17 counties. 15 are very rural in nature. 2 are very large. And so we are working across the state to ensure that, you know, if it is a small rural community is impacted with even one positive, they don't necessarily have the services that they need. And so we as the larger counties have to be able to step in and help that. And so their health care capabilities are very limited. So what we're trying to do in our state is to ensure the whole state is healthy and that the whole state, and that we're tracking the data so that we can determine where our hot spots are, figure out if there's any opportunity for us to see if there's any similarities within people that were tested positive. So, and it's more than just tests, and I am no healthcare provider at all. But what I'm learning across our state is there's two components to the test. So you need the agent, most importantly, so that you can read the test in a timely fashion, but to ensure that we have the whole piece of the test kit, but knowing that we have the medical supplies, most importantly, so that our first responders and our healthcare facilities are set up. And that is a unique position for Nevada to be in because of the rural counties that we have as well as the large counties. So I encourage anybody to go to our state website to see some of the data. We have it listed by gender. We post it every morning at 10 a.m. We talk about who's doing the testing. So I encourage people to go and look at that.
Thank you for that. And just a reminder, if you have a question, hit *3 and we'll get you into the queue. Let's go to Jason Delgado from Politico. Jason, go ahead and ask your question, and please address it to the person that you're asking it to.
Mr. Chase, good afternoon. Speaking of pitting regions and governments against each other, yesterday the U.S. Conference of Mayors penned a letter to Washington, and they were asking for them to lower the population requirement from 500,000 to 50,000. Two questions. Did you agree with their sentiment? And two, I've spoken with other mayors of large cities, and they have concerns. So can you offer reassurances to some of these larger cities that don't qualify?
Well, first of all, let's be clear that there are multiple pots of money in the Senate package that will benefit state and local governments. People have been focusing on one specific program, the state stabilization program, or it's actually called the Coronavirus Relief Fund in Section 601. What we have been asking for is that they provide enough money for all states, tribes, and units of local government. From our perspective, since counties have 1,000 hospitals and public health responsibilities and have different roles and responsibilities, we are spending more money on this crisis than some of our peers. So we are pushing to make sure that we were eligible. We preferred that counties have the ability to tap into U.S. Treasury directly. We also understand it's tough for Treasury to deal with 50 states, territories, 18,000 cities, and 3,000 counties. So we're trying to be practical. What is really important to note is at least what we're seeing in the draft finals, and can't say they're finals, but that each state will have a minimum, that those cities and counties and other units of government above 500,000 will have direct access to the Treasury, but that all local governments are still eligible to work with their governors for assistance. And so some people are saying that if you're below 500,000, you're not eligible. That's not what we're reading. It's just that you won't have direct access to apply to the Treasury. You'll work through your state.
Any quick follow-up, Jason?
1.25 that can be allocated to the state?
That is what we are seeing in the versions we have.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Thank you.
A minimum of 1.25 for each state. Billion.
Thank you.
Billion.
Thank you for that, Jason. Let's go to Vinny Bella of Philadelphia Inquirer, and please address your question to the specific person you want to ask.
Thank you. This is for Dr. Arkush. I'm just curious about more details for the hospital dashboard that is being created region-wide that you mentioned. Specifically, if this is a tool that will be available to the public or if it's just an internal device meant to help with planning for elected officials.
Thanks, Vinny. I think at least initially some of the data will be mostly for elected officials and hospitals to use, but we are very much hoping to make components of it available to the public. So I still don't have that all those facts yet in terms of exactly what we're going to be able to pull together to give an accurate regional snapshot, but I will tell you that those conversations are happening in our five-county area, and we're hoping that this could be a pretty robust tool for a number of different uses.
How many hospitals are involved? How many hospitals are involved in this at this point?
I can't speak to the specific number of hospitals, but I will tell you that in the calls that I've been on, the major health systems in our region have been participating on those calls.
Thank you, Vinny. Let's go to Jessica Priest of USA Today. Go ahead and ask your question, and please direct it to whom you'd like to respond.
Hi, thank you so much. I would like to talk to the county leaders. I'm wondering how you can conduct like open meetings with your governmental bodies, if y'all are meeting by video or telephone, and how you're making sure that the public is still involved and able to ask questions, not just about coronavirus, but any other regular business that you guys have.
So here in Douglas County, we did a couple of things. We social distanced within a meeting room, kept to our, we have the 10 person rule, and so we kept the room limited to 10 people. We also then went to having fewer than the 10 in a room with video conferencing. We are constantly using our social media, press releases, print media, radio, TV to get the word out to our citizens. But during those video conferences or meetings that we have, we do allow the public to chime in if they have a question for us. So it's an open meeting. We're still following the open meetings laws of Nebraska, which is our format different.
Okay. Did you receive any instruction? Like, I'm here in Texas, and the governor has, like, suspended parts of the Open Meetings Act. Is that what's happened in Nebraska?
Well, somewhat, but the governor, they're basically a challenge saying the governor can't grant that to local municipalities, and so that's why we came up with the kind of an adjustment to that where we still can do teleconferencing or video conferencing, but we have to have a quorum of commissioners in a room to conduct the business. So like the other day, we had four commissioners in the room, but on video conference, there were the other ones were on the video conferencing.
Okay. And are there is there a specific, like, program you're using for video conferencing or involving the public? Are you doing, like, Facebook Live? Are they calling in at a number?
We're using the Google Meets or Hangouts,
okay,
which has worked well for the few county board meetings that we've done that way.
Did I hear Dr. respond?
Okay. Sure. Yeah, I can tell you what's going on. Well, I can tell you what went on in our last meeting, but we might have to alter it somewhat now that we have a stay-at-home order in place. So there's been no state action here in terms of what happens with our meetings. We were publicly streaming our meeting before this pandemic came here, so that has continued. We have only three commissioners on our county board of commissioners, so we were able to get all three of us in a room with at least 6 feet between us and just a couple other key staff for our last meeting. We were keeping the total number of people in the room to no more than 10, and we did have room for actually two members of the public to be in there, and again, with enough social distance. But we only had one, and then we had a backup location, again, with chairs placed socially distant that the meeting was being streamed into, and then if those individuals wished to make public comment, they would be able to come one at a time into the actual room that we were in to make that public comment. Now, that was before we had the social distancing rules in place. So we are before we had the stay-at-home order in place. So we are trying to decide what to do for our next meeting, and we'll have to just keep you posted on that.
So this is Mimi Hall in Santa Cruz. We do have the shelter-in-place order, but government as essential business is exempted from that. And what we've actually done is a combination of things. The department heads and those giving reports join the meeting virtually through Microsoft Teams. And then we've actually set up two physical spaces joined by video conference to spread out the physical rooms that the public can visit. And then in addition to that, any public, and they're all with, you know, chairs 6 feet apart and keeping in line with our social distancing guidelines. And then in addition to that, people can email or message their public comment into the clerk of the board who will read those out loud in the public session. It's more things. This is how we did our last meeting, and I imagine that as time goes by, we'll find other ways to comply with the open meeting rules.
Okay.
Any very quick follow-up, Jessica?
No, thank you.
All right. Thank you for your participation. We're going to go to Jacob Fischler with a CQ roll call. You're live. Go ahead and ask your question. And please direct it to the person who'd like to respond.
Sure. This is Matt. On the Senate bill, obviously the I know you don't, there's more to it than just the Title VI, but I'm curious kind of how long you expect that funding to last. In other words, when do you project that counties and local governments will need more? Also, the language, I think, limits it to payments of March 1st or later and directly related to the pandemic response. Does that present any problem at all from your point of view?
Yeah, so great. Thank you, and always good to talk to you. I think, yes, we're appreciative of the $150 billion. There are some restrictions on there, as you know, about related to the expenditures related to public health. I think the big unknown right now for our counties is the lost revenue. In the fact, it doesn't appear at first glance to see, to capture lost revenue. As Commissioner Patrick noted, in Clark County, which is the home to Las Vegas, and a county of 2 million people, where the city is really only, 500,000, they're seeing a swing in their budget of $1 billion. Not all of that is increased expenses. A good portion will be lost sales tax. It'll really depend on the nature of the county's revenue sources. If a county is much more dependent on property tax, they may be in a better shape. If they're in a state like Ohio or Nevada and California, in some cases where there's a big reliance on sales tax, we could see significant drops. New York also comes to mind, where the counties rely heavily on sales tax. So we wish that it did include the ability to recapture some revenue, but we also are thankful that we got the $150 billion in generally discretionary funding.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jacob. Let's go to Ryan Johnson of statescoop.com. Go ahead and ask your question, and please direct it to the person who wants to respond.
Hi. So this is a pretty open response question. I'm wondering what the role of county technology officials, county chief information officers, and chief technology officers can be during times like these, or what they've done so far in your respective counties.
So this is Marilyn.
Go ahead, Marilyn.
Thank you. I just want to talk about that's one of our biggest challenges, and as we've been working for the last few years on smart communities across the country, connecting the unconnected, we just in one department, our family services department, we had to connect 900 people on one server just to have them out in the field to work remotely. So out of our 10,000 employees, we've had to figure out a system to connect 6,500 people at the same time during the day, and that's brought a lot of challenges for us. The websites having to get updated quickly, the ability to virtually have our meetings online and get people invested, and that's really something that NACO has taken the lead on for the last 2 years to ensure that everybody across the country has the technology. So what we found, there are spots within our urban areas that there's no technology available to do that. So it has really been a challenge. It is very expensive cost that we're having to navigate right away to ensure that folks can do that. And so as technology today, we have to also prepare for the hacking. So we have to upgrade our licenses. So it is a very expensive cost to try and ensure that we still can provide those essential functions. And technology is at the top of the list and the timing on how we put all that together.
This is Sal Arkosh. We've actually put up a pretty robust data hub using GIS mapping type of software that gets updated every day with the number of cases that we have in the county, the municipality in which those cases are located, and a whole host of other trusted resources of accurate information for the public. And we, like I'm sure many of my colleagues, have had to very rapidly move to what are called COOP plans, continuing of operations plans, or continuity of operations plans. And we have, we're on a limited operation here at the county now, so we have our workforce working from home as much as possible, and our IT folks have been absolute heroes in this effort, making sure that people had the right equipment and the right programs loaded on that equipment and knew how to use it to make sure that they could work effectively from home. You know, we talk about these things, we have practice drills for these things, but until you do it for real, you never totally know just where the kinks are. So our IT folks and the director of our GIS work have been absolute heroes in this effort. This has been an all hands on deck, and we are really grateful to them.
This is Mary Ann. I just want to say, Douglas County, I agree with what my colleagues have said, and the GIS and IT have become an absolute instrumental resource for us in addressing this, from us buying tablets for all of our attorneys to be able to communicate with our incarcerated men and women of our correction facility, to actually doing hooking up courts remotely from or in judges' homes. So they have been absolutely instrumental in all of this.
Thank you, Ryan. Now let's go to Carl Smith of Governing Magazine. Carl, you're on, and please let everyone know who you're directing your questions to.
I wanted to direct this to Dr. Arkush. Various speakers have mentioned good compliance from the public regarding their stay at home or other orders, but we've also seen some examples of folks ignoring this, and certainly to some extent people across the country are getting messaging that can be conflicting. I just wondered what you would say are some of the best strategies for communications and even the sort of best content to help really convince people that this event is not like some of the events that they are comparing you to, that they give them the excuse to push to be allowed to return to work or school or open their business or have a party with their friends.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So what we've done here in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, is really try to educate the public that the goal with the social distancing and stay-at-home orders is not necessarily about them personally. It's about our entire community. So by staying home, they protect our first responders, our police, paramedics, and firefighters, and they protect our hospital workers as well as the hospitals themselves. They protect the people that are working in our grocery stores and our pharmacies and all of the people working on the supply chain to make sure that our grocery stores and pharmacies can stay open. We've explained how staying home helps prevent spread. We've had charts and graphs. Pretty much, we do a daily press briefing every day at 3, and we try to have at least, we don't do it every single day, but most days, we try to have at least one educational chart or graph to help visually explain why these things that we're asking people to do, which are enormously disruptive to their lives, are so important. And we've tied those messages to the fact that there is no treatment for this disease. So if someone, particularly someone who's at high risk, who's elderly, immunocompromised, or has multiple serious medical conditions, does contract this disease and gets a serious case of this disease, there is literally nothing that we can do that's been proven to treat them other than provide supportive care, which means, you know, do our best to try to get them through it. that supportive care may involve having to be placed on a ventilator to help get oxygen into their bodies, and that all of those things are scarce right now. We have pointed to Italy and now are starting to, with great respect and humility, that it isn't us, reporting, pointing to New York City, that if people don't stay home, this could be what's in store for us. And at least in my county, we found that to be fairly effective. There's a really interesting website that came to my attention yesterday that is using anonymous cell phone tracking data to look at how much travel has decreased within counties since early March. And when I looked at it yesterday, it was lagging by about 4 days. I think it was up to March 20th or March 21st. But here in Montgomery County, we were the best county in Pennsylvania, and we were down about 56% from where people, the amount of traveling around that people were doing in this county in early March. Now, I have no idea how accurate this is, but I just give that as one example of people do seem to be paying attention, and we have had relatively little pushback. I think the hardest thing is for parents, particularly of young kids. I have a couple of teenagers, and that's been hard enough, but parents that are home with young kids who, you know, maybe are really frightened about this and are so used to seeing their friends every day and having play dates and having to say, no, you just can't do that anymore. And the other one piece, last piece of this is that in Pennsylvania, people are still allowed to go outside and exercise. So if people want to go for a walk, a jog, a bike ride, that is still allowed as long as they are practicing social distancing. So obviously they can walk next to their household contact. But if they want to walk with a friend, we ask them to keep at least 6 feet apart. And we're seeing that happen in a lot of places. And I've seen more people out exercising than I've ever seen. So I guess that's one very small bright spot in this story.
Let's take Penny Starr from Breitbart News Live. Penny, go ahead and ask your question, and please let folks know whom you're directing it to.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. This is for Mimi and Marilyn, because you both seem to have a very different approach to dealing with the incarcerated population in your county. I believe that Mimi said that they had decided to evaluate the risk of inmates and release them, whereas Marilyn said that they're using testing to kind of contain that population and the risk for infection. Could you expand on why those decisions were made and what you're going to be doing going forward?
This is Mimi from Santa Cruz. This is Mimi from Santa Cruz. So I just do want to say that as with communities, all of our situations in the corrections environment are different. For us, we had a pretty crowded jail situation, and one of the things that kept us up at night is if we had a positive case in the jail, we didn't have the room to isolate, cohort, all of those kinds of things. In addition to that, in California, we have a severe testing shortage, as much as the nation does, as well as a PPE shortage. So knowing that we didn't have the personal protective equipment to protect both those who work in corrections and then also folks who are staying there, we knew that we had to take these measures. So it really is a protective and preemptive measure, and we have worked in partnership with law enforcement and then with our human services department to ensure that folks have a place to stay. We're not releasing people if they don't have a home to stay in. We've made arrangements to try to find housing for our low-level offenders that are being released.
And this is Marilyn. And so what I would tell you is we have a two-pronged approach. So we consistently work very hard to keep a minimum of a 10% vacancy rate within our jail so that we have the ability to move folks around no matter what. That's one of our standard protocols that we work very hard in the county to do. We are currently not arresting people for misdemeanors because our courts, so the courts, the sheriff, and the county are all working together so that we only have the worst of the worst in jail, and we don't currently move them if they are sick. We've never done that. That's one of our protocols. But we do have the capability, unlike some other jurisdictions, to have a 10% vacancy rate so that we can isolate if needed. Currently, we're taking extra precautions of testing not only our correctional workers as they come in to ensure if they have a temperature, but also checking our inmates on a daily basis so that we can stay on top of it and isolate those folks that may have symptoms. So I think for Clark County, it's a two-prong approach, and we are fortunate to have vacancy rates. And I'm actually headed to a press conference with the sheriff because we still have the responsibility to provide public safety, and we still have to ensure that residents feel safe in their own homes.
Yeah, and this is me. I would like to add that we're taking the measures as well in terms of temperature checks and all of those kinds of things. And in addition, our sheriff has suspended visitation.
And so that, one more question. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. I apologize. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to follow up that we're also working with the state on parole and probation violations. So that if there's other ways that we can handle it, we're trying to do that.
And with that, we're going to take one more question. Afterwards, we'll have closing remarks from NACO President Marianne Borgeson. Here is Kate Quirum from Route50.com. Go ahead and ask your question and direct it to whom you'd like to respond.
Hi, thank you. My question is for all of the county officials, and this has been touched on in some of the other questions, but some of you had mentioned that county staff had begun transitioning to telework, and just because so much local government work seems like it would be difficult, if not totally impossible, to do remotely or from home, I would love some insight into how you've implemented that and just how it's going so far.
Well, I'll talk about Clark County. So we are working, you know, we have a responsibility to our employees as well that they feel safe doing their job. So we are getting good response. We've worked with many of our employee groups to see what is functional that they can work from home, as well as we still need bodies within the facility. So our big thing is to ensure that they do have some type of PPE equipment for the ones that are there. So we are asking them if they're sick to please stay home. We're telling them we have other employees that have volunteered and stepped up to man the phones within our different locations. In Clark County, we have 320 county buildings. So we are still responsible to provide a service. So we're seeing quick feedback today, not without some hiccups along the way, but I'm thankful that my employees have been super helpful, solution-driven on how we can provide those functional services and who best can do it from their home and who best can do it from a building.
So this is Mary Ann from Douglas County, Nebraska, and we basically just did a survey, if you will, of who we thought would be able to provide their service through telecommuting or those areas in which we needed to have the 24/7, like our long-term care, our corrections, our youth center, 911, sheriffs. They're actually coming up with a few different models in order to make sure that we have staff that will continually be able to be there. We are running into some issues with our long-term care. There was already a shortage, which everybody knows across the country, with nursing. And so we are seeing an increase in overtime in that area. But there are some that you just can't telecommute, but others we did as many as we possibly could.
And this is Mimi Hall in Santa Cruz County. We've taken many of the measures that my colleagues on the call have taken. In addition, all of our public employees are deemed disaster service workers. And so we issued early guidance before our actual enforceable order for all workplace guidance for the entire county, not just the county workforce, but all employers and workplaces. And so it was important for us to early on start thinking about that. And just as in the other counties, employees have been innovative and creative and supportive and helpful to assure that their coworkers who were the most at risk had the ability to stay home. And as this has morphed, because we did this early on, we did find that there were employees that had less ability to work from home but wanted to work. So they've been assigned to do other things. We have a call center set up. It's a Q&A for community members and other folks. We have grounded out some of our departmental operations center and our emergency operations center with those staff. And we've also authorized alternative schedules, overtime, and on-call because some of our divisions are working 7 days a week in different shifts, and some of them have much less demand as other kinds of services have gone to online or less in-person encounter service. We've been really proud of our workforce.
So I do want to add, though, to be mindful that we have to keep our employees fresh because as we open back up as counties, that's where the workload is going to be a lot. For instance, my health district employees, they're going to be responsible for putting 10,000 permits in place. So we are doing everything that we can to keep our employees fresh, rested, and healthy because we see for the long term that they're going to be taxed in a way that is going to be hard for us to manage. So it's important that the employees be part of the solution now because 6 months from now they're going to be probably working twice as hard as they are today just to get us back on track.
That's a really great
question. Well, I want to thank everyone. Oh, go ahead.
So I was just going to say in Santa Cruz, we're calling this the lull before the storm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank everyone for participating in today's call. I want to pass it off to NACO President Marianne Borgeson, who will now give closing remarks.
Well, I too want to thank everyone for your time. This is, again, it's been amazing that you have taken the time to talk with us as long as you have today. If you have additional questions, please don't hesitate to reach out to us. But then also don't forget about the NACO resources that we have that have been talked about throughout this teleconference. So, again, I thank you. I thank my colleagues. I thank everyone that's on the phone. And, again, enjoy your day and please be safe.
Thank you for joining us today. That ends our call.